Hey, Henry. I just rewatched The Little Mermaid for the first time in 20 years. It's about this girl, Ariel, who is born in a body that doesn't feel right to her, and she longs to be the one thing that her father most disapproves of. A human woman. She even sits in a hiding place where she keeps all her human things, staring longingly into a mirror wishing her body was different. This want drives her to sneak into this party where a bunch of men are dancing with each other, but things get complicated and she ends up kissing this guy. He's the only person at this point who sees her as a human woman. Then her father finds out and loses it and destroys everything in her hiding place, leaving her in tears. Ariel is then approached by Ursula the Sea Witch. I think Ursula used to be a mermaid, but like Ariel, she desired to transform her body and give herself legs. But Ursula's legs are these grotesque octopus tentacles. Also, Ursula is modeled after the famous drag queen Divine. So this older woman, who is depicted as a monstrous version of a man in a dress, offers to use her magic to make Ariel pass as a woman. But in exchange, Ariel won't be able to use her voice anymore. And that's just the first half of the movie. So this week, I want to tell you why I think Ariel from The Little Mermaid is totally trans. I am Ada Rhode Short, an activist, academic engineer, and queer trans woman whose pronouns are she, her.
And I'm Henry Jardina. I'm a writer, a critic, and a trans guy. My pronouns are he, they.
This is Totally Trans, searching for the trans canon, where we talk about some of the most well-known figures from film, literature, and media.
And tell you why we think they deserve to be part of the transcultural canon.
This week, we are talking about Ariel from the 1989 Disney animated film, The Little Mermaid. Before we dive into the film, I want to give you a little refresher on the state of trans culture in 1989, and then give you some information about the people who made the film. So, the most recent explicitly trans film character was Angela Baker, who originally appeared in the cult classic slasher film Sleepaway Camp in 1982, but had most recently been played by Bruce Springsteen's younger sister Pamela Springsteen in the third movie in the franchise, just months before The Little Mermaid premiered. Interestingly, in all of her appearances, Angela had been played by a cis woman, which was one of the last times we were going to see that casting strategy for a while. It is safe to assume, though, that most people going to see The Little Mermaid had not even heard of these movies. More notable trans characters in the 1980s included Roberta Muldoon in The World According to Garp in 1982, played by John Lithgow, and Luis Molina in The Kiss of the Spider-Woman in 1985, played by William Hurt. Lithgow was nominated for an Academy Award, and Hurt won an Academy Award for his performance, setting a precedent in Hollywood that we are still dealing with today. Interestingly, The Little Mermaid came out just before an explosion of trans representation in film in the early 1990s, indicating that trans issues were bubbling up in the public consciousness. Representation was very sparse and included just a few binary trans men and women. For the purpose of time and relevancy to this episode, I'm going to focus on trans women who are notable in America. A lot of the cultural consciousness around trans women in the 80s was still bound up in the transsexual memoirs of Christine Jorgensen, Jan Morris, Kanari Khan, Hetty Jo Starr, and Lily Elba. These memoirs tended to focus on the trope of being in the wrong body and the godlike transformative powers of the surgeons who helped them. It is notable that these memoirs were often partially, if not wholly, written and edited by the doctors that performed their surgeries, and they tend to fit a cis-heteronormative narrative that one scholar likened to the old morality tale of the truth of gender told by a kindly white patriarch in 1966. That scholar, scientist, and all-around badass trans woman was Sandy Stone, who was notable for many reasons at the time, such as her cutting-edge research and work with Jimi Hendrix as a recording engineer, but had become infamous in the trans-exclusionary feminist circles of the time because of the 1979 book, The Transsexual Empire: Making of the She-Male, by notable meanie Janice Raymond. In the book, Raymond attacked Stone by name, misgendered her, and said every horrific thing imaginable. Have you read it, Henry?
I have, back in college. I consider it to be a foundational TERF text. I think it is really one of the first instances of someone directly like targeting trans women and saying like, you're threatening women or you're taking femininity away from cis women somehow.
Would you recommend that our listeners read it?
I mean, if you have a strong stomach, I think it's important to read it. But if you don't, those ideas have basically at this point filtered down to the point where, like, you know, J.K. Rowling is still bringing talking points from the transsexual empire. Writers in the UK are still spewing that rhetoric. So it's like, it's not anything new.
I think personally, I'm probably going to avoid it as long as possible. Anywho, luckily I don't need to respond to it because Sandy Stone responded to Raymond in her article, The Empire Strikes Back, a Post-Transsexual Manifesto, in which she examines the prevalent cultural myths and narratives around transsexual women and suggests that we must move past this view and become post-transsexual. Sandy originally wrote this article as an essay in 1987, but it wouldn't be published broadly until 1992. However, I feel like it really encapsulates some of the themes present in The Little Mermaid, so I'm going to reference a lot in this episode. When talking about these concepts, I will use transsexual in the context that both Stone and Raymond use it to refer to trans women who sought out bottom surgery and other medical interventions during this time period, though this language would become antiquated very shortly after this in 1991. One final historical note is that this movie came out just 4 years after the 1985 Supreme Court case, Ulane versus Eastern Airlines, which found that trans women were not protected by Title VII against discrimination, establishing that they could be legally fired. So who made this movie? All films are collaborative efforts, and that is especially true of animated films. The idea was originally conceived of by the writer and director, Ron Clements, in 1985, and it was based off of the Hans Christian Andersen story of the same name. It was initially rejected because it was too similar to a planned sequel to the 1984 film Splash, which is also totally trans, by the way, but it was later given the green light by studio chairman Jeffrey Katzenberg. Ron Clements then teamed up with John Musker, who he had co-written and co-directed the 1986 film The Great Mouse Detective with. However, after writing a 20-page rough script, the project was temporarily shelved to focus on Oliver and Company, which was believed to be more profitable because it wasn't a girl movie. However, as been attested to by several documentaries about the making of the film, the Disney Renaissance, and the man himself, the course of the project would change when Howard Ashman joined in 1987. Howard Ashman was an actor, director, and writer born in 1950 in Baltimore, Maryland. Interestingly, 4 years after queer director John Waters. Howard, as he's referred to in all of the documentaries about him, was a gay man who was part of the off-off Broadway independent theater movement of the 1970s and 80s, and had gained notoriety after directing and writing the lyrics for the musical adaptation of Little Shop of Horrors, which was later adapted into the 1986 film of the same name. Also in 1986, Howard was working on a Broadway musical adaptation of the camp beauty pageant film Smile, which was not as successful. Many people have described Howard's choice to move across the country and take a job in California, working for Disney, as an attempt to escape his sense of shame over its failure. Upon arriving in California, he was originally supposed to focus on writing a song for Oliver and Company, but he quickly became involved in The Little Mermaid by not only writing all of the lyrics to the songs, but also recruiting composer Alan Menken, who he had worked with on Little Shop of Horrors, casting actress Jodie Benson, who had been in Howard's adaptation of Smile, and making large changes to the plot and script. He also picked character designs for Ursula the Sea Witch, which becomes important later in this story, and directing musical vocal performances. On the final film, he was credited not just as a lyricist or writer, but as a producer for his massive creative contributions. During this time, he also began to work on Aladdin and Beauty and the Beast, both of which also explore concepts of transformation and social stigma. In 1990, Howard won an Academy Award for the song Under the Sea. He would later win another Academy Award for Beauty and the Beast in 1992 and be nominated for Aladdin the following year. But he would not be able to receive those accolades due to his untimely death at the age of 40 from complications related to AIDS. Howard had been diagnosed with HIV in 1988, halfway through production on The Little Mermaid, and initially kept his diagnosis secret from Disney out of fear of being fired. A more complete history of his legacy can be found on Disney Plus in the documentary Howard. There are two quotes from the end of the documentary that I think are really telling. The first comes from theater producer Thomas Schumacher, who said about Beauty and the Beast, quote, was an AIDS metaphor. Metaphorically done at a time when I don't know if the creators of it were aware what they were creating. And from Howard's sister Sarah, I don't think he put personal life in anything he wrote or did. But what there really was with Howard was great empathy, which means that he could put himself in other people's places. Between those two quotes, I think that we can find an artistic truth that Howard was perhaps not consciously writing the stories that he was surrounded by, but as an HIV-positive man in the New York fringe theater scene of the 1970s and 80s, inevitably would have been exposed to trans people, their lives, and their stories. And he likely incorporated those elements into his work.
If you haven't watched the Disney original documentary Howard, I highly recommend it. I wrote a review of it and we can link to that in the show notes. It's a really incredible movie, both about the production of this film and all the films he was involved in, and also just a history of New York and Broadway pre-AIDS into the height of AIDS and the effect that had not just on Broadway, but on Disney itself, on film production itself. It's a great watch.
The final important context is our personal relationship to The Little Mermaid. In my case, I was first introduced to it on home video when it was released in the early 90s, and my older sister and I, both beautiful redheads, watched it obsessively for reasons I couldn't articulate at the time. And I remember playing Mermaid, and later the more heteronormative Aquaman, in the pool. However, after being reintroduced to it through the critical lens of the documentary Mickey Mouse Monopoly, I avoided it for nearly 20 years. What's your context for The Little Mermaid, Henry?
Like you, Ada, I was introduced to this via the classic clamshell. I was obsessed with it. I loved it. I loved Ursula so much. And I was just a kid who loved Disney, and I would always pick up on the characters in Disney that were sort of ulterior or not the main character, because I never identified with Ariel, because I was just like, she's a girl who likes boys. Like, boring. I don't care. Ursula? Now that bitch, love. Love at first sight. Before I knew anything about she was inspired by Divine, before I knew anything about the queer context, I glommed onto her and was obsessed with her. And that's kind of been my hook for the movie. Like, for me, it is Ursula's film. And she is just as much of a trans presence as Ariel's. Her story is just as much trans as Ariel's story. But I think the interesting thing about Ursula is a lot of her story is left to our imagination.
Yeah, we're going to touch on a lot of that in this episode. And then probably come back and revisit Ursula in her own episode in the future, because there is so much ground to cover.
Absolutely.
With all of that out of the way, let's start going through the movie. If you'd like to watch it before listening to this section, please pause here and go watch it. It's currently available on Disney Plus. The film opens on various ocean creatures frolicking before a ship carrying sailors, including Prince Eric, appears on the screen over expositional dialogue about merpeople. Tiny note, Prince Eric is voiced by Christopher Daniel Barnes, who also voiced Spider-Man in the 90s Fox Kids animated series, in case you were trying to place where you knew him from.
And Prince Eric and his very obviously gay butler / handmaiden Grimsby is like talking to him about the sea, whatever. And then this like fisherman dude has a fish and he's sort of flapping it at Grimsby and it flies away and it dunks back into the ocean, breathes a sigh of relief. And then we get the music and the credits. And I think what's really interesting about this way of opening the film is that it centers the viewer on the side of the fish, which we rarely see. We rarely see a movie, especially a cartoon, about people who eat meat from the view of the meat that is being eaten, essentially. And I think this moment of just the fish sighing and then traveling into the safety of the ocean reminds me, there's a 1986 biopic starring Vanessa Redgrave about Renee Richards. And there's a line in it where she says, "A free fish can never know how a hooked fish feels." And she says this in response to somebody who's basically asking her, like, "Why are you trans?" So I think it's just a very interesting metaphor and an interesting way to sort of bring us into the story and establish the threat that Ariel's father is so paranoid about. Like, it's a real threat. You know, people eat fish. People kill trans people.
There's some really interesting stuff around that predatory nature that comes up in the song Under the Sea that I'm going to tell you about in a few minutes. We then travel into the depths of the ocean, following a fish over the title cards and seeing various sea creatures. We then see our first merperson in silhouette, a presumed presumably male figure. He then joins a number of silhouettes that honestly look kind of spermy. The spermy silhouette swims through a very yonic cave before reaching a golden castle that appears to be made out of a bunch of dicks. They then swim through and somehow enter a more yonic gateway. And this anatomical imagery is a running theme throughout the film. And while it may be subconscious or unintentional, it is definitely interesting. So we are then introduced to King Triton, Sebastian, and Ariel's sister in a concert where they perform as mermaids. I see this as a form of gender performativity, though Judith Butler wouldn't coin the term until 1990. Another running theme throughout the film is going to be Ariel's struggle to perform as human and mermaid. Another word for discussing that is habitus, which is the way we carry ourselves and manipulate our bodies to communicate our sense of self. Ariel's not at the concert because she is literally exploring humanity by searching a shipwreck for human artifacts. She does this with her friend Flounder, a fish who is characterized as a young boy who's definitely struggling to perform masculinity.
I have a lot of thoughts about Flounder. He's sort of like Ariel's chubby gay friend. The sea is actually a shitty provincial town. It's like a conservative, shitty Midwestern town where like there's one fucking restaurant. And I think Flounder is like her rock, where it's like, you and me, we're the gays, we're going to do this.
So as Ariel searches the wreck, she and Flounder are attacked by a shark. Ariel risks being eaten to retrieve her collected human artifacts, stored in a purse. And then Ariel escapes the shark by passing through an anchor that, because of the framing of the shot, looks like the Venus or woman symbol. The shark is incapable of passing through this gendered portal, and Ariel and Flounder are able to escape. Ariel and Flounder then go to Scuttle the Seagull, who tells them very inaccurate information about humans, which reminds me a lot of very bad misinformation I received as a child when trying to find out information about trans people.
I mean, honestly, I love Scuttle so much, even though he offers nothing. I sort of got like wacky trans elder energy about him, but I've had a lot of experiences where before I was about to get top surgery, like trying to just see images, like, and this was, you know, 10-ish years ago. So before you could sort of like go on Instagram or like even Tumblr and sort of see people post-op. And I sort of like wandered onto like, I believe Michael Brownstein's page. And there were a lot of just very bloody looking, for lack of a better word, pictures. These were clearly pictures just of people who had like just had this surgery. And it like freaked me out a lot. And I kind of didn't revisit the subject for a while because of that.
Yeah, I've had some experiences, especially as a teen, where I both found some community in online forums, but not necessarily healthy community. So after speaking with Scuttle, Ariel realizes that she is late for the concert and hurries off, at which point we are introduced to Ursula the Sea Witch, who is secretly watching Ariel. Ursula's character design is really interesting. Before she is fully revealed, she says,
"In my day, we had fantastical feasts when I lived in the balance."
Which I think is really interesting because it's a line that sets up this whole past history that's not explicitly stated. As she says this, her body is revealed to not be a typical mermaid, but she's in fact half octopus or squid, depending on who you ask, the term for which apparently is a Cecilia. To me, this implies that she used to be a mermaid, but she transformed her body into her current tentacled form.
First of all, I love Ursula's entrance from just a cinematic point of view. You see her eyes glowing and she's just speaking out of a vagina, basically like a darkened vaginal cavern. But I think Ursula's setup is really interesting because she is shown as having this like, quote unquote, monstrous body. But you see throughout the film that Ursula can take basically any shape she wants. Like, she's magic. We know this. She can do whatever she wants. She can be whoever she wants. She chooses to look the way she looks. And we see her throughout the film applying cosmetics, taking great pleasure in looking in the mirror and in like doing up her hair. She's the only person in this film who like pays attention to her appearance in any way. And I think she genuinely loves herself. And that is really hard for the rest of the sea world to understand. And setting up the fact that she is something that's a little more quote-unquote monstrous than a mer person is already setting her up to sort of carry a lot of the heavier symbology of the film, while Ariel gets to, I think, live a more conventional or show a more conventional style of like A to B transitioning, whereas Ursula seems a bit more non-binary and sort of eager to play around with gender and appearance a bit more.
Yeah, I definitely see that. I think as far as it being a morality tale type structure, one thing I think is specifically interesting about the tentacles mm-hmm. is that the thing Ariel seeks out for some body affirmation is giving herself legs. And we can see that Ursula has given herself legs, but she's chosen to give herself legs that aren't necessarily human, which I think is really interesting in the context of the time.
Brief note for budget reasons, she doesn't have enough tentacles. Like, everything about her is just completely like outre and gender fuckery. Like, she doesn't give a shit. She can't even fit into like a quote unquote like cis octopus life.
But then again, by showing her as like this monstrous but powerful figure, it actually brings us back to the image of transsexual women being pushed by Raymond in her turfy text, The Transsexual Empire, and Mary Daly in Gyne Ecology as perversion of nature. This is further reinforced by the fact that her design was based off of the drag queen Divine, who had been made famous by the other famous queer filmmaker from Baltimore, John Waters. In other words, she's being depicted as a man in a dress who has transformed herself into a monster by transforming her bottom half.
Just a quick word on Divine. I think Divine is such like a beautiful woman. And obviously Divine was not trans. Divine was a drag queen. But I think like the thing that's so liberating about Divine and that makes her sort of canon for me, even though she wasn't trans, is like she fucking loves her body. She loves the way she looks. And she's beautiful. I feel like that's an incredibly radical thing that people sort of miss when they talk about Divine, because yes, it was part of the John Waters filth, but John Waters referred to her as the most beautiful woman in the world, or almost the most beautiful woman in the world. And I feel like she has that energy where it's like, I dare to not look the way a quote unquote beautiful woman should look, but I am fucking beautiful. It's a fact. I don't care what you say. And Ursula has that same energy. She's like, I'm big. I'm powerful. I've got muscular fucking arms. I'm gorgeous. I don't give a shit. And it's notable that every other merperson that we see that I noticed is very slender. There aren't really mermaids of size in this world that I identified. There's not great diversity of size. So I think them using Divine's body to sort of make a statement about quote unquote monstrous beauty is just endlessly interesting to me.
For me, I personally love Divine and am low-key obsessed with John Waters. Also, while Divine wouldn't necessarily identify herself as trans, I definitely identify a lot of the characters she plays as trans.
It's not discussed openly in the film, but like, she's a woman in those films. It's not disputed, it's not questioned. It's like, yeah, she's a woman.
So, Ursula's minions, Flotsam and Jetsam, a pair of eels, are also kind of interesting because they are essentially a single character and they're only referred to as they, them, which is neat, but I don't have much other takes on, so we're just going to move on. In the next scene, Ariel is in trouble for missing the concert and Flounder is explaining why they were late when he says they went to visit Scuttle on the surface. This enrages King Triton, who doesn't want Ariel interacting with the dangerous human world.
Do you think I want to see my youngest daughter snared by some fish eater's hook?
I'm 16 years old. I'm not a child.
Don't you take that tone of voice with me, young lady. Well, as long as you live under my ocean, you'll obey my rule.
But if you would just listen.
Not another word. And I am never, never to hear of you going to the surface again. Is that clear?
So I think this is an exchange that a lot of trans people, especially young trans people, can really relate to, where our explorations of gender identity are often policed and pushed back against by our parents, often aggressively being strict for our protection and just trying to let us live a happier and safer life. This exchange has been sort of memeified in recent years, but in the context of a trans narrative, it hits really differently. One thing I thought particularly interesting was Jodie Benson's performance of Ariel in this scene, in which her voice is a lot more androgynous than the hyper-feminine Disney princesses we'd seen before.
The scenes with Triton are very hard for me to watch because we've all had those conversations with our parents. Cis parents only know setup where because I'm older and wiser and the parent, I clearly know what's best for my child. And when your child is trans, that is not necessarily true. And in many cases, completely the opposite. So it does sort of lead to these endless arguments of the trans kid being like, just listen to me. Just take me seriously. Put aside the fact that I'm young. I know what I want and I know who I am. And as my parent, you need to respect that. That struggle obviously plays out here in a really sad way and violent way, frankly.
I completely agree. And I found when I was actually isolating these clips from the video that they were actually kind of more emotionally hitting. So just prepare yourselves for that emotionally, listeners, because we're coming up on one sequence that I found really upsetting to hear out of context.
Brace yourself.
So Ariel swims away in tears, and Sebastian and Triton speak. Triton is unsure if he was too strict, and Sebastian says he would keep her under constant supervision if she was his daughter. Triton then orders her to follow Ariel and essentially police her and keep her away from human things. Sebastian follows Ariel and Flounder to a cave, again, Yannick imagery, where Ariel keeps her human treasures. This really reminds me of my skirts, underwear, clothing, trans porn, and other things that I hid as a teen until my mother found them and threw them away. What the fuck, Mom? Ariel then sings. Sorry.
There's going to be a lot of what the fuck, Mom, what the fuck, Dad in this movie.
That's actually really interesting, and we'll talk about that more later. But the director saw this movie as centering the narrative from a parent's perspective, which is really interesting.
Wow, yeah, that's very surprising.
Yeah, like they saw it as a morality tale, but for the parents.
Oh, actually, there are a lot of useless fathers in Disney, and even the like hyper-masculine ones like in Bambi are sort of off at a distance. So I think this is a rare case of an actual, like, very stern, strict father in Disney.
One other thing I think is interesting on that is Sebastian acts as a co-parent through a lot of the movie and grows increasingly accepting and supportive over the course of the film, which is a dynamic we'll talk about more later. So Ariel then sings the song, A Part of Your World, which I would love to play clips of, but I'm definitely not going to touch that copyright battle with the 10-foot pole. So notably, Howard Ashman had a fight to keep this in the movie because executives thought it was boring and didn't see the point.
And I feel like this is the important point when he decides, like, no, you need to structure your films like a Broadway musical. The leading lady needs to have an I Want song so that we know what she wants and we're rooting for her. What, like, their animation department was floundering and they did not think that, like, musicals were even, like, the thing to do. So Howard Ashman was, like, directly responsible for implementing that, and now it's sort of a feature in every Disney film. Like Moana has it, Frozen has it. It's just something that Disney now does as part of its brand.
The lyrics to A Part of Your World are really interesting. They open with the line, look at this stuff, isn't it neat? Wouldn't you think my collection's complete? Wouldn't you think I'm the girl who has everything, which feels deeply and incredibly trans in a way that doesn't even feel allegorical. And she continues, how many treasures can this cavern hold? Again, calling back to the themes of Yannick imagery going throughout the entire movie. And then she says the one thing that broke my heart the most when she settles down on the ocean floor while saying, what would I pay to spend a day warm in the sand? Which for any of our trans listeners, which I'm assuming is most of our listeners, is a really relatable sentiment because a lot of us really struggle with trying to feel comfortable at the beach and in swimwear. And one thing that bottom surgery personally changed for me was that it allowed me to feel more comfortable at the beach.
Yeah, one of the first things I thought about, I would like for years just go to the beach in my binder and sit there and sweat. And it's like after top surgery, the first thing that happens is like I can just wear a normal ass bathing suit like everybody else. And I can go in the water and have this not be a thing. And like, it's just the simplest thing that cis people just never would think about. But for us, it's like, holy shit, this is huge. I can actually maybe have a good relationship with the beach now, like crazy.
Do you have any thoughts about the song in general?
I mean, I find this song just to be achingly beautiful and very sad. I think it captures like a perfect synthesis of like being a teenager and just really wanting to like be your own person and live your own life and have some control over the decisions you're making. Like, I'm ready to do this. I feel like a fully formed person. I think it's both a great just way to sort of showcase her yearning and a way to tie it to something very concrete. Like, she literally wants to not only transform her body, she wants to live in a completely different like sphere. Part of Ariel's desire is to just be in a place where she can fit in. And that's a very real teenage desire and a very real trans desire.
At the end of the song, they discover Sebastian is watching her, and Sebastian responds with, "What do you think your father would think about this place?" Ariel and Flounder ask him not to tell him before he marches off. Ariel's distracted by flashing lights coming up through the hole in the top of her cave. Ariel follows rainbow flashing lights of fireworks upwards to a boat populated by sailors in tight shirts dancing with each other, which is very gay. She sees Prince Eric for the first time, and Ariel says, "I've never seen a human this close before." There's then a very sudden hurricane that ends up sinking the ship. Eric rescues Grimsby and his dog, Max, but ends up getting caught on the boat when it explodes and is rescued by Ariel. We then cut to Ariel and Eric on the beach, and she is unsure if he is dead. I thought that they kissed here, but they don't. There's just a lot of weird caressing and strange framing that kind of makes it look like they do.
Also, I feel like the framing of the shot when he wakes up and sees her and she's sort of like all fuzzy, to me that was a very like post-op shot. Like the kind of like you're looking at like the doctor or whoever the first person is you see in very like rosy or like, holy shit, like you're the first person I see in my new life.
Grimsby starts to approach and Ariel flees. This leaves Eric thinking that she was a human girl, though, which in the trans narrative means he is the first person to see Ariel as herself. We then end on a moment where Ariel's singing, "I don't know when, I don't know how, but I know something starting right now. Watch and you'll see. Someday I'll be part of your world." Which to me feels like the moment of self-acceptance and the decision to seek out transition.
It's a perfect end to Act One. I love this moment because I can see Howard Ashman in it so much to the point where it like almost makes me cry. Like, I just feel like I see his genius guiding Ariel along every step of this movie to make sure that we like love her and understand her and know what she's going for and don't view her as this disobedient kid. You see how it connects to like her going after Prince Eric. It's not just about like a 16-year-old girl with a crush. She feels seen by him. And that is a big, important bond. I think like the first person who really like accepts you as a trans person, I think it's normal to fall a bit in love with them because it's like, oh, fucking finally. Also, the waves crashing against her is like a clear masturbation metaphor that I love.
We then go to Ariel being all lovey-dovey and her family assuming she has fallen in love with a merman. Sebastian is hesitant to out her, so he explains to her that being under the sea, i.e. not transitioning to be a girl, is better through the Oscar-winning song Under the Sea. This song reminds me a lot of talks I got as a kiddo about how it's better to be a cis man, which were always kind of gross and weird, and I'm sure you've had similar experiences, listeners. The lyrics to the song include lines like, "The human world is a mess, life under the sea is so much better. Take it from me, out on the shore they work all day, out in the sun they slave away. While we would have Odin, full time to float in, under the sea." To me, these all feel like variations on like, you don't want to be a girl, transitioning is hard and being a boy is better. He then explains that on the surface, fish are kept either in a bowl and unhappy or eaten with the lines, "The fish on land, they ain't happy, they sad cause they in their bowl, but fish in the bowl is lucky, they in for worser fate. One day when the boss gets hungry, guess who's going to end up on the plate?" Bringing up images of kept domesticated women, as well as misogynistic and trans-misogynistic violence, which is dark, but not inaccurate. Then poor Flounder gets pulled into this cis-hetero-patriarchal nonsense when a female fish starts grinding her booty on him seductively while he tries to run away, because Flounder is the softest babe.
That's a minor fish lady.
Anywho, I think that this Oscar-winning musical number could be seen as Sebastian arguing for the merits of the cis-heteropatriarchy and the benefits of male privilege. The comp-het subtext can also be seen as a reflection of the anti-trans narrative pushed by reactionaries like Janice Raymond. What do you think, Henry?
Yeah, this reminded me of like being like 8 or 9 or something. My mom gave me like a book of like inspiring like famous women. And she's like, "You should be more excited about being a woman." And I was just like, "What? Huh?" It's just all this kind of like smoke and mirrors that cis people do trying to convince you that like being cis is fun or even an option. And it's just like, absolutely not. Like Ariel, I love that Ariel simply leaves like halfway through the number. Like, we just don't even know when she leaves. We just know that she's like out of there, probably like by the halfway mark. Also, can I just note that one lyric stood out for me? Yeah, we in luck here, down in the muck here. Oh yeah, the muck of gender essentialism. Why would I, like, live this horrible life? What do you get in return? Who cares that the fucking newt plays the flute? Big deal.
A messenger then summons Sebastian to talk to Triton, who thinks Ariel is in love with a merman and questions Sebastian. But Sebastian cracks, revealing that Ariel is in love with a human, and Triton loses it. In an anti-human rampage, Triton makes Sebastian take him to Ariel's hiding place, where he finds her oogling the statue of Eric. He then scolds her, and this scolding quickly escalates. I'm going to play a clip really quick. If you have issues around, like, your parents and violence and aggression, probably skip forward a few seconds, because it gets a little disturbing.
Daddy!
I consider myself a reasonable merman. I set certain rules, and I expect those rules to be obeyed.
But, Daddy,
is it true you rescued a human from drowning?
Daddy, I had to.
Contact between the human world and the merworld is strictly forbidden. Ariel, you know that. Everyone knows that.
He would have died.
One less human to worry about.
You don't even know him.
Know him? I don't have to know him. They're all the same. Spineless, savage, harpooning fish eaters. Incapable of any feeling.
Daddy, I love him!
No. Have you lost your senses completely? He's a human. You're a mermaid.
I don't care.
So help me, Ariel. I am going to get through to you. And if this is the only way, so be it.
So Ariel is left in tears, and Sebastian feels awful and tries to apologize, but Ariel sends him away.
I think this scene is so instructive. Rule number one of being a queer trans kid, don't tell your dad about your feelings, ever. Don't tell your dad. Probably don't tell your mom. I feel like this is just the worst thing that could happen when, like, they shut you down in the most violent way possible. And I think that's, like, the real threat of letting your parents in on your emotions. They have a lot of power. So I think that's why this scene hits really hard. Literally everything she wants has been destroyed. All her desires have been destroyed. And it's so painful.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with everything you said. And it's such a hard moment to watch. Two things that I think are interesting to talk about in this context. First of all, like, especially at the time in which this was made, I think that this is very representative of a lot of people's lived experiences. I remember that when I initially came out as queer to my parents, I'd talked to other adults in my life that I knew were supportive, and I had a bug out bag ready to go if I needed to leave. I think that is less of the overwhelming narrative. And there's much more acceptance and support from parents, but there's still so many cases. So if you need some sort of help, like, reach out. There's plenty of resources online.
Please do.
And then additionally, I think it's really important within the context of the movie being framed as a morality tale for parents, that this is sort of Triton's darkest moment. So then Flotsam and Jetsam approach her and offer to help her make all her dreams come true. She initially turns them down, but then reconsiders and follows them to Ursula's home. Ursula lives in this skeleton of a sea monster. The entrance to her lair is lined with these sad creatures that had made previous deals with Ursula, but failed to keep up their end of the bargain. This reminded me a lot of toxic and scary internet forums that will not go named. Ursula is putting on makeup at her vanity, demonstrating that she knows how to perform femininity. She explains,
"The solution to your problem is simple. The only way to get what you want is to become a human yourself."
Can you do that?
Ursula then explains that she loves to help poor, needy merfolk like Ariel, and the song Poor Unfortunate Souls starts. The first thing Ursula says in this song is explaining that she's no longer the toxic person that people in the community say she is, which is flatly false. She is the worst.
But how can it be a lie when she says, true? Yes. She's literally like a person on Twitter who's like, before you call me controversial, it's actually true what I'm saying.
She is definitely a problematic fave for this episode. Mm-hmm. A few parts from the song that I wanted to highlight are, and unfortunately, I know a little magic. It's a talent that I always have possessed. And here lately, please don't laugh. I use it on behalf of the miserable, the lonely, and oppressed. Aside, pathetic. She demonstrates this visually by showing like holograms, I guess, of her making someone skinnier or more attractive and various other transformational powers, allowing people to conform more to the images that they find desirable. So knowing that Ursula has the power to change her into the body that she desires, they make a deal.
Now, here's the deal. I will make you a potion that will turn you into a human for 3 days. Got that? 3 days. Now listen, this is important. Before the sun sets on the third day, you've got to get dear old Princey to fall in love with you. That is, he's got to kiss you. Not just any kiss. The kiss of true love. If he does kiss you before the sun sets on the third day, you'll remain human permanently. But if he doesn't, you turn back into a mermaid and you belong to me.
No, Ariel!
Have we got a deal?
If I become human, I'll never be with my father or sisters again.
That's right. But you'll have your man. Life's full of tough choices, isn't it? Oh, and there is one more thing.
We haven't discussed the subject of payment. You can't get something for nothing, you know.
But I don't have
it. I'm not asking much. Just a token, really, a trifle. You'll never even miss it. What I want from you is
your voice.
My voice?
So that clip has a lot of meaning. And I think that meaning expands past the text into a lot of the cultural context at the time. Mm-hmm. Ursula responds to Ariel returning to song. You'll have your looks, your pretty face, and don't underestimate the importance of body language while she gyrates her hips back and forth in a demonstration of feminine habitus, specifically for the purpose of attracting men. She continues with, quote, the men up there don't like a lot of blabber. They think a girl who gossips is a bore. Yet on land, it's much preferred for ladies not to say a word, but they dote and swoon and fawn on a lady who's withdrawn. It's she who holds her tongue who gets a man. This brings us again to The Empire Strikes Back by Sandy Stone. In her manifesto, living legend Sandy Stone describes how, in order to get the god figure of the surgeon to grant the miracle of changing gender to transsexual women, they had to construct what Stone calls a plausible history. Quoting from the text, learning to lie effectively about one's past, what is gained is acceptability in society. What is lost is the ability to authentically present the complexities and ambiguities of lived experience. Or as Ursula would put it, it won't cost you much, just your voice. To me, this is the biggest piece of evidence for The Little Mermaid, not just as a trans narrative, but specifically a transsexual narrative within the cultural context of its time. And Ariel, as a character, struggling to live within the confines of that transsexual narrative without giving up too much of herself. Ariel agrees and looks nervous when she gives up her voice, afraid she is seeing that part of herself for the last time, as Ursula licks her lips hungrily while she captures it in a seashell. Again, more yonic imagery. Ursula then transforms Ariel, and we are shown a naked human form in silhouette, visually reflecting the merman at the start of the film. A terrified Ariel, who can no longer breathe underwater, is then helped to the surface by Flounder and Sebastian. Henry, what is your take on this whole sequence?
This is an important scene because this is the beginning of our Faustian pact. We have Ursula, oh, I'm going to give you what you want. but you have to pretend you're something that you're not in order to get past this gatekeeping. Yeah, it's she who holds her tongue who gets a man is interesting because have a gender essentialist framework sort of being placed on to transness at this time to say, like, the only way to be real or accepted by society as a trans person is to prove that you are, like, the essential woman. Last thing, the image of her being transformed is extremely violent. Literally, her fin split in half.
Yeah, literally getting cut between the legs in her transformation. The next time we see Ariel, she is clinging to the same rock that she was on earlier when she declared that she would finally transition. She looks at her feet with mute astonishment that can only be described as pure body euphoria, and it honestly brings me a lot of joy. When she stands, she stumbles and falls, which is one of the first examples of her failing to embody the habitus of a human woman, which will be a running theme in this act. Sebastian threatens to tell King Triton.
My nerves are shot. This is a catastrophe. What would our father say? I'll tell you what our father'd say. He'd say he's gonna kill himself a crab. That's what our father'd say. I'm gonna march myself straight home right now and tell him just like I could have done the minute. And don't you shake your head at me, young lady. Maybe there's still time. If we could get that witch to give you back your voice, you could go home with all the normal fish and just be miserable for the rest of your life. All right. I'll try to help you find that prince. Boy, what a soft shell I'm turning out to be.
This marks a turn in Sebastian from being complicit in the policing of Ariel's embodiment to being really supportive and sweet, which I really like for him. It's really reminiscent of a role that we would see played out by a co-parent, and their relationship plays out more as a motherly and fatherly role, especially in this second act. Aware that they can't just let her jam out with her clam out, her animal friends make Ariel a dress from old sails in the tradition of several other Disney princesses. Scuttle is very supportive and affirms her, even though she is an absolute wreck. This is when Eric encounters her, and initially he recognizes her, but when she can't speak, he replies, "You couldn't be who I thought," which is a heartbreaking consequence of Ariel's new constructed, plausible history. We are then shown Ariel getting cleaned up and dressed in beautiful clothing, while women in the castle gossip about her. Even though Ariel looks the part, at dinner she again struggles with habitus. First, using the fork as a comb, getting a strange look from Eric that makes Ariel embarrassed and insecure. On a side note, it's really worth drawing attention to how good the animators did at a character that couldn't speak and had to communicate purely through human facial expressions. She then tries to play a tobacco pipe as an instrument, blowing ash into Grimsby's face. Failed habitus, as well as phallic sexual imagery. But this time it's seen as more charming than the fork thing.
It's interesting to see the intercutting between, like, Ariel being really excited to be in this new environment, and then we see Sebastian, who is literally living in a world where he is food, where before he was living in a world where he was a person, essentially. And I think, like, the French chef dynamic is basically what creates the radical empathy that Sebastian comes to feel. It's like, this is how she feels. Obviously a much more violent depiction of the process. Like, in Living in the Sea, she's felt hunted and shitty and kind of having no control or no way to protect herself or no way to be herself. And now I'm literally fighting for my life on Earth.
Yeah. And what I think is interesting about that is the emotional weight on it, because on my first rewatch of this, I thought that the chef sequence with Sebastian was really weird because there's so little fluff in this movie. And we don't just see the chef and Sebastian here, but they, like, return at the finale of the film. So it's like a running gag throughout the movie, which is really interesting in a movie that's otherwise so concise. Later that night, Ariel is watching Eric from her balcony, and Eric spots her, making her blush and shy away. As Ariel is crawling into bed, Sebastian coaches her on feminine habitus while she falls asleep, again with this focus on seducing men, which is not great, but also representative of the compulsory heterosexuality of the transsexual narrative prescribed by the medical gatekeepers at the time.
This has got to be, without a doubt, the single most humiliating day of my life. I hope that you appreciate what I go through for you, young lady. Now, we got to make a plan to get that boy to kiss you. Tomorrow, when he takes you for that ride, you gotta look your best. You gotta bat your eyes like this. You gotta pucker up your lips like this. You are hopeless, child. You know that. Completely hopeless.
We then cut back to Triton sitting in his throne, very mournfully saying, "What have I done?" What do you feel about the parent dynamics, especially given the director's stated view of the film as a cautionary tale towards parents?
This scene that you're talking about, it's just sort of like a zoom out and you just see how alone he is in this gigantic green sea throne. And he's just sort of like, what the fuck did I do? And then after Under the Sea, there's a similar moment with Sebastian where he's mounting this impromptu musical theater number. And then suddenly everyone's deserted and he's just alone on the rock and you pull out and see how small he is. So I think it unconsciously is a very interesting way of framing how often the attempts that parents make to protect their children from becoming trans will leave them alone and isolated and probably regretful.
In the next scene, Ariel and Eric go on a date. Ariel manic pixie dream girls all over the kingdom to Eric's delight, and eventually the date progresses to a romantic boat ride through a swamp. Eric then tries to guess her name, which is a moment in the movie where I am just screaming in trance. He's like, "Oh, but what's your real name?" And Sebastian corrects him. I don't understand if humans can understand fish talking. And this is where we get to the song Kiss the Girl. Sebastian attempts to help Ariel by composing romantic music. Again, very supportive.
I think the Kiss the Girl number is interesting because visually it's all just penis jokes and vagina jokes. Literally, there's a shot from below where you see the boat and it's surrounded by like fish. And then there's a certain point where the fish are just like, jizz, is this supposed to be romantic? Get out of here. It's like extremely sexual imagery, but like romance?
One thing I really love about this is how the plot hinges on an enthusiastic consensual kiss, which is pretty great, especially when compared to like more problematic examples like Sleeping Beauty and Snow White, where the princess is unconscious. Before they can kiss, Flotsam and Jetsam tip over the boat to stop them. And then Ursula, who is watching from her lair, transforms herself into a more conventionally attractive human woman in order to sabotage Ariel on the last day, because she is so toxic.
One of my favorite lines in the whole film is, "It's time Ursula took things into her own tentacles." That's the moment I'm like, bitch, yes. Let's inject this love story with like a little bit of juice. I think it's interesting when she transforms into Vanessa because it shows us that Ursula can look like anything she wants. Ursula is not confined to like one body or one shape or one taxonomy. She can be fucking whatever. She chooses to look the way she looks and takes pride in that. And that's like exciting. The only thing she needs is the voice.
Later that night, Eric is about to go to Ariel and presumably kiss her when he hears Ariel's voice coming from a mysterious woman and is magically entranced by it.
Eric's fucking useless. Grimsby is like, "Don't you like this redhead chick who you've been hanging out with?" He's like, "I guess." And then like just takes Ursula taking a conventionally like pretty girl disguise and having the voice. Magic, sure.
The next morning, Scuttle informs Ariel and Sebastian that Eric is getting married, and Ariel assumes it is to her because she is a sweet, dumb baby and it breaks my heart. And then she is distraught when it's revealed to be Vanessa, who is secretly Ursula in disguise. They're going to get married that afternoon on a boat specifically for weddings, which is dumb, but also I want one. And Ariel is left crying on the dock as the sun is setting on her third day. Scuttle then catches Vanessa monologuing about her plan and goes to tell Ariel. Ariel then goes to the boat with Flounder's help, while Scuttle delays the wedding with the help of a bunch of sea creatures. In the scuffle caused by Scuttle, the seashell necklace that Ariel's voice is trapped in is broken, which achieves three things. It allows Ariel to reclaim her voice and speak her truth, outing herself to Eric. It breaks the spell Ursula had put on him, and it robs Ursula of the ability to construct a false narrative about herself using Ariel's own voice. As exemplified by Ursula crying out,
Get away from her!
In her lower, raspy voice, switching back from Pat Carroll, where she'd previously been voiced by the voice actress for Ariel, Jodie Benson. I think that this is really interesting because as she cries out, Ursula covers her mouth in embarrassment, which is honestly kind of like a big mood moment for me. But again, stealing somebody else's voice is not a very nice way to deal with your own voice dysphoria.
She still has kind of like a sexy husky voice.
Right as Ariel and Eric are going to kiss, the sun sets and Ursula reveals her true form while laughing maniacally as Ariel is transformed back into a mermaid. Ursula then grabs Ariel and they jump over the edge of the boat. And then Triton comes to rescue Ariel, but he can't do anything because of magic legal contracts. In order to save Ariel, Triton sacrifices himself, allowing Ursula to transform him into one of the creatures from her cave. And then she takes his crown and Triton, becoming all powerful. This takes us into the final confrontation between good and toxic, manipulative sea witches. It starts when Ursula is about to kill Ariel, but Eric rescues Ariel from Ursula with a harpoon. And then Ariel rescues Eric by forcing Ursula to miss while attempting to blast him with the Triton. And in the process, she vaporizes Flotsam and Jetsam, and their bits and eyeballs float to the ocean floor. And it is honestly very horrific. Ursula then becomes a gigantic, monstrous version of herself and creates a vortex in the ocean using her powers. Very Yannick imagery. She proclaims, which I feel like is reminiscent of the surgeon as God narrative criticized by Sandy Stone. Ursula traps Ariel at the bottom of the whirlpool, but Eric kills Ursula by penetrating her abdomen with a very phallic boat. Ursula's body is unable to accept this penetration, and she literally explodes. After she explodes, bits of her body float down into the ocean, releasing the merpeople trapped in her cave and allowing them to regain their agency that had been stripped away.
I want to note two things. So first, where Eric and Ariel are sort of swimming on the top of the sea, and there's a moment where Eric and Ariel are trying to embrace, but they are interrupted by the, literally like a phallic prong of Ursula's crown. It just fully comes between them and splits them apart. And I was just like, this is wonderful. And also, the voice distortion when Ursula is talking about how she's all powerful is very interesting and telling, because it becomes like neither masculine nor feminine. It just becomes this sort of god voice. And I think it's kind of like we are seeing her at this moment lose the last of her humanity, for lack of a better word, because she's obviously a fish. And I think just like using her voice, as her voice has sort of been used through the movie to show this, is super interesting, especially amidst her being the literal barrier between the lovers. It's interesting that she becomes this imposing, like very low, deep voice, monstrous figure. There's obviously a lot to unpack there.
We then cut to Eric laying on the shore, being watched by Ariel from her rock, who in turn is being watched by totally heterosexual friends, Sebastian and Triton. Originally, there wasn't going to be any dialogue here, but Howard Ashman added a line that was described by director John Musker as what the movie is all about in the documentary Treasures Untold, Making of the Little Mermaid.
It's like I always say, Your Majesty, children got to be free to lead their own lives.
You always say that?
Oh, then I guess there's just one problem left.
And what's that, Your Majesty?
How much I'm going to miss her.
Triton then uses his magic to transform Ariel into a human, fully accepting her choice and supporting her. This support goes beyond the transformation that Ariel had previously experienced at the hands of Ursula, because instead of being left naked, afraid, and vulnerable, she is given a beautiful, sparkly dress and retains her voice and agency.
I mean, my big thing with this scene, I would love to feel good about it, but to know that Triton really could have fixed this problem extremely early and just been like, sure, if that's what you want, cool. And that he waited until people were killed. Too little, too late, Dad.
So obviously, Ariel and Eric get married. And in the final line of the movie, a now human Ariel in a wedding dress hugs King Triton and whispers,
I love you, Daddy.
And I fall apart and ugly cry into my popcorn.
And I really hate her wedding dress.
In these final moments, The Little Mermaid stops being a transsexual narrative framed by a false, plausible history and becomes something new. In the words of real-life cyborg Sandy Stone in Empire Strikes Back, Ariel begins to write oneself into the discourses and becomes what Stone would describe as post-transsexual, embracing the complexity and reality of her lived history. Going into the 1990s, we see an explosion of post-transsexual narratives in pop culture, both good and bad, but mostly bad. And a movement away from the term transsexual as a label, soon to be replaced by the broader transgender, which was popularized by scholar Holly Boswell in 1991. So that's it, Henry. What do you think?
I sort of have mixed feelings because, again, I'm not sure why Ariel has to completely say goodbye to her life in the sea. As a kid, when I sort of read Ariel's story as like a heteromantic story, I was kind of like, well, that's fucked up. It's like she completely trades in her family for this dude that she doesn't know. And now it's like the relevance of that makes more sense in the context of her chosen family. But I'm still kind of like, oh, so you're just never going to see these people, your sisters, you're never going to see them again? Like, okay.
I think if you look at the story through the lens that director John Musker viewed it through as Triton's emotional journey, it kind of makes more sense that it ends this way with him having to make the change within himself to be able to accept her and grant her these changes to her body, which to him was not even an inconvenience. It was something he could just do at will, which I think actually says a lot about the ways that we interact with our families, is it's like, oh yeah, all you have to do is like change your mind. I have to do all of the hard stuff.
Yeah, like Triton, throughout the movie, he's being told what he has to do. And it's literally, it's not just like accepting Ariel, it's literally relinquishing power. He just wants to control her. The thing about like him being the one to actually like transform her feels weird because it's kind of like we're moving from Sandy Stone's like God surgeon idea to like your parent. I don't think parents should have that kind of control to begin with. Oftentimes, that power, and so often it just takes endless talks and convincing to get them to understand.
For me, my experience with my parents and my transition was fraught, to say the least, which is getting increasingly hard. So I really liked that, like, in the movie, the emotional conflict isn't around Ariel's accepting of her body and deciding to change it. We get through that in the first act, and that's kind of like her emotional journey around her gender.
Yeah.
Versus her father's is way delayed and takes the rest of the course of the movie for him to get to the point where he's like, okay, I see that this is important to her. And to have her as part of my life at all, I need to do something to meet her in the middle. I don't necessarily see the ending either as him completely cutting her off and like them not being able to have the connection, because that was kind of like Ursula's false dichotomy she created. Like, I assume that they, like, hang out on the dock and, like, have tea or something.
Aww.
And, like, talk. And, yeah, I see him as, like, an ongoing supportive family member.
The fact that she says goodbye, though, and they're all sort of sending her off. Like, yeah, it could be, like, just a honeymoon thing. Like, we'll see you when you get back. But to me, it felt so much like we have to let her go from this community. And she can't, you know, once she's one of them, she can't be one of us. I also find it interesting that Triton, in order for him to sort of come around, not only does another cis person have to sort of set him straight, in this case it's Sebastian, but I feel like if we're translating the text of this story to sort of like real life correlations, I would think that this whole incident with Ursula and the fight, I think in real life that would translate to something like a suicide attempt. I think it would be like a desperate action that a child would make to sort of like last gap. I'm finally convincing you that this is actually life or death. And then the parent gets it.
Yeah, I think that's really fair.
Right. And she's 16. Like, let's not forget that she's a child.
A baby. Yeah. Teeny, precious baby.
Yeah. He's relinquishing any control or like, and I think this is a hard thing for a lot of cis parents of trans kids, where it's like, you know, when you have a kid, you have a lot of fantasies around that kid's future, and many of them are gendered. And it's kind of like, you can't tell a parent not to like fantasize or project about like, you know, their kid having a happy future that looks like this and involves this kind of love or this kind of community. And then when a kid comes out as trans, often the cis parent will just be like, oh, but you're going to have a miserable life. And more importantly, your life won't look the way that I want it to look and that I'm comfortable with. And then I think eventually parents of trans people either learn to throw all that stuff out and like adapt to like the reality of the trans person's happiness and what it looks like, or they sort of stay stuck in those fantasies. And I think Triton's growth here is that he's like, you know what, your future looks, you've been able to envision a future that I never could have imagined for you. I can't protect you. I can't help you anymore. And that is kind of a heartbreaking moment for a parent, especially a cis parent, to realize like, I've thought that I've been in this protector's position forever, but really I could never protect this person from anything. And in fact, I've been hurting them this whole time.
I also actually really relate to the idea that they can sort of meet at the interface of their worlds after this, like sort of like at the surface of the water and like at the shore. But in a lot of meaningful ways, Ariel can't go home and her father can't like come into her life, which has been a struggle I've had with my own parents, where I don't think, in fact, I know because we've had this conversation, that they don't really understand my lived experience and what my day-to-day life is like and the stuff I deal with. And they can't come into that world or understand that world.
Yeah.
And in a lot of meaningful ways, I can't enter their world or understand their world either. I can code switch to exist at the edges of it, but it can't really plumb its depths.
I can see my parents' lives and concerns as valid. Cis people enjoy protections and sort of ways of coping and even just ways of thinking about normal life processes that like I don't have. And like, yeah, code switching is not a thing for them. They're always just who they are 100% all the time. And yeah, it can sort of feel like you don't have a lot in common with those people.
Yeah. So, do you have anything else to add?
Oh, yes, one thing. What do you think the like Ursula's garden of XC people, like, what do you think that's about? Because in my head on this watch, I was like, they're detransitioners.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Because it's like she's giving them what they want and then immediately taking it away, but in this way that like creates this like shriveled husk of like a person. Like they don't even have personhood anymore. And like she just sort of like collects them in this creepy way. Like, I was thinking about, because obviously like the Kira Bell stuff is really on my mind right now.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking about it in terms, especially after you talked about like Ursula's place is like this trans forum that's super toxic. It's like, yeah, and all these detransitioners are just hanging out there.
Yeah, I had not thought about them in the context of detransitioners. I think for me, it's sort of that those are the people that have kind of like fallen to the violence of like the medicalized transsexual establishment, where they're the people who like couldn't keep up their plausible history or whatever their deal was, their bargain is with this godlike transformative figure, and then experience some sort of punishment. So I see them, I guess, in that historical context as being sort of the this is what happens if you don't follow our rules. Mm. But then it turns out that we just need to like throw out that whole paradigm and do something new, which is sort of what they do by tossing aside the previous icon of like Ursula as this trans body. By destroying that, they sort of liberate everyone to live their expressed lives. Mm. Yeah, that's sort of my take. The detransitioners take super interesting.
I always, like, as a kid, I remember thinking this too. I was like very curious about who those people were. And I was like, I don't understand even what taxonomy they are. But the fact that they were like, looked really sad and they were trying to keep like catch a hold of Ariel, but not in a menacing way. It was almost like, we're warning you, but like, you're not going to take our warning seriously because we have zero personhood and we're just weird ass sea shrubs or whatever the fuck. But yeah, it was definitely like interesting on this watch. And also thinking about Ursula as like the, not only like the town witch or the town sort of like surgeon, but it's interesting that she always knows what's going on. Like she always sort of see, like when Ariel comes in, she like tells her, she's like, I know your fucking story. Like as the plot is unraveling, she's sort of watching. So she also has this like town gossip function of like, I know everybody's deal. I know everybody's stuff. And I know how to sort of like trick them into trusting me, which just makes her more interesting and wonderful to me as a character.
Yeah. So hopefully in season 2 or 3, we'll have our episode Why Ursula is Totally Trans, where we look at her with a much more sympathetic lens. So what type of representation does this feel like? Is this more of direct gender stuff happening or allegorical in your opinion?
I've always thought of it as highly allegorical, but on this watch, it feels very obvious. It fits perfectly. And I think, like, even though gender is not really discussed in any clear way, I think it's like all the benchmarks that you talked about sort of fit perfectly into this. And I think it's not too far of a stretch to imagine that, yeah, Howard Ashman saw this for the story, even without maybe expressing or being aware. And it fits just very well into this, like, children's story. It's like a seamless, like, this is something I'd show to someone of any age and not think twice. It is a very accessible film. It's just like a very basic story that feels explicitly trans, or at the very least queer.
Because I'm a giant nerd, I've made a 4-point scale for us to rate texts on. It goes from headcanon, major gender stuff happening, all but explicit, to literally trans. Where would you rate this?
I think it's all but explicit, honestly. What about you?
Yeah, I think it's all but explicit in that, like, it doesn't ever use the word trans or discuss explicit trans things at all. But as far as all but explicits go, this is like a 3.9 in my head because of how much it reflects the trans discourse of the time in, like, a really meaningful, sympathetic, and at times heartbreaking way.
It can be taken as, like, such a basic, just, like, coming of age, growing up thing. But when you are queer, I think you identify this movie as powerful, like, unspoken way, which is, like, a huge accomplishment for Howard Ashman and for Disney. And this movie is one of the reasons why I really can't write off Disney. Because, like, yeah, they're an evil corporation, but guess what? They're telling these stories, and, like, they're one of the few spaces where it's okay to tell stories like this.
This episode is the first in a 3-part series searching for trans representation in Disney films before we switch gears entirely to discuss Truman Capote's 1958 novella, Breakfast at Tiffany's. So if you want to read along, find a copy now.
We have a Patreon that can be found at patreon.com/totallytrans.
Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode, and rate and review us on Apple Podcasts because we live in a cyberpunk nightmare oligopoly.
Join us next week when I will be telling Ada why I think Pinocchio is totally trans. Totally Trans, Searching for the Trans Canon, is co-hosted by me, Henry Giardina, and you can find me on Twitter at Punk Groucho.
And co-hosted and edited by me, Ada Rhodes Short, who can be found on Twitter at The Ada Rhodes. That is The_ADA_RHODES.
All quotes and audio clips are being used under fair use.
And our music is royalty free and was found on Pixabay.
Keep searching.
I love me a cheesy heteronormative romance.
I think the rainbow at the end was what did it. I lost it. I think I saw two mermen with their arms around each other, but I saw the rainbow and I saw two somewhat androgynous mer people and I fully lost it. So it's a very moving.